Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 29th of October. An article in Scientific American caught our attention, looking at hotspots in the world and asking, is focusing on hotspots the key to preserving biodiversity? Preserving biodiversity in rich habitats is good, but global warming and other new threats may call for a new strategy. We're going to talk about what it means, focus on hotspots. We'll look at how we have been able to save individual species around the world and what methods have been used to save species. Our guest this hour is John Watkin, who's grant director of the Critical Ecosystem Partnership Fund at Conservation International. And our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, as always, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, John. Thanks so much for being with us.
Morning, Kathleen, and thank you very much for the opportunity.
Oh, yeah, it's our pleasure. Let's talk about hotspots, and the focus has been on hotspots, I understand, for some years now. What does it mean to focus on hotspots? Where are they? What's the strategy?
It's an opportunity to try and define areas around the world which have which are reservoirs for the greatest number of species, which aren't often in areas that have been part of a traditional protected area network, and as a result, they are invariably highly threatened. Hotspots are defined by a botanical criteria, and they have 1,500 endemic species of plants, species which are not found anywhere else in the world, but have already lost more than 70% of their original habitat. That's sort of the hot aspect of the title.
And those would be primarily tropical forest areas, or what, John?
Absolutely. There are some temperate regions. The island of New Zealand, the islands of New Zealand, is a hotspot in its own right. But these are areas that were contiguous habitat after the last glaciation. But subsequent climate change and anthropogenic pressures have actually fragmented them down to areas literally lying between the Tropic of Cancer and Capricorn.
Mm-hmm. And if we preserve as much biodiversity as possible, how do we accomplish that? What needs to happen to those areas? There would be no more tearing down of rainforest, or what do you mean to protect it?
There's a whole sort of assembly line of tools that we use to try and promote conservation of these areas and maintain habitat in integrity at the moment. We also look at trying to reconnect fragmented patches of habitat with corridors and make sure that there is free movement of species in between habitats which are vital to their existence. There's always a human component to what we need to do, and we have to address that first and foremost in terms of making sure people can still have livelihoods and actually they have healthy and productive livelihoods rather than being compromised by a conservation approach. So integrating local people into our activities to promote conservation and benefit local livelihoods. But then there's also a district and policy and a national level to look at this, because a lot of deals that governments will sign can coincidentally have a negative impact on these habitats that we're trying to preserve.
Mm-hmm. And what about those livelihoods? There are obviously a lot of people who do make their livelihoods from getting the lumber that comes from these areas, et cetera, from probably killing some animals that live in these areas as well. It seems like this would be a major problem. How do you switch their livelihoods so they can make a living doing something else? What's that something else?
Kathleen is absolutely right. What's happening is that a lot of people are in very marginal areas and they live very close to the poverty line or well below it. So a lot of their actions at the moment, through a lack of awareness or understanding, are actually sort of cutting off the nose to spite the face. What we try and do is promote alternative livelihood activities that actually have a benefit to the habitat and add a second string to their rural economies, which are often based on agricultural practices. So we've been very successful in several areas promoting butterfly farming. So when some of your listeners go to these beautiful butterfly houses which are springing up around the country, and they see butterflies flying, well, they have invariably been produced through community conservation programs around forests, where they harvest the adults and put them in a cage and allow them to breed. And then once the larvae have grown up through to becoming pupae, they can be shipped to these destinations and go through all the quarantine that's required to be released and put on display for people. In one part of Tanzania where we've been working, the community there who've been involved in trained and involved in producing butterfly pupae for export have earned about $50,000 last year from these activities, which promote a very strong link with maintaining a healthy, intact forest.
Do you still find yourself in a position of having to, and I'll ask you to do that for us in a moment here, sell the idea of biodiversity, explain why it's important to the future of this planet?
Absolutely. It's something that when you are on the inside of the conservation arena, it's a language and a jargon that we're all familiar with. But actually, when you go out and talk to people, it's disturbing how little aware people are of the problems out there. And that when people are watching Discovery Channel, for example, and they say, oh, I love seeing those programs, they don't equate that to the fact that it's all being removed at a rate of knots. I think trying to improve general awareness of what's going on and finding the right means to do that with social marketing campaigns and making sure that everybody can actually know that they can have an impact locally by changing their practices to promoting sustainably produced food and furniture and everything else that we often take for granted. My mainstay is whether my mother can understand what I'm doing, and that is for me a very good way to ground truth myself.
And she does understand.
Finds it very hard sometimes, but I try.
I think you do a pretty good job of it. Give us an idea of what's happening with various species. How many are we losing? I've read that we're losing so many to extinction that you can come down to measuring this of one every half hour, the loss of a species?
That was an estimate from some sort of bootstrap mathematics. But it's very difficult to define because we don't know the total number of species that we are dealing with. Many species are going extinct before they've actually been described to science. So we are in an unknown state. I think we have to sort of look at how many species in the taxa that we're most familiar with, and primates especially are being decimated through a combination of habitat destruction and trade. Especially, say, in the Indochina regions of Thailand, Cambodia, Vietnam, the combination of logging and bushmeat consumption or trade for people who prefer to have primates as a source of protein. The figures are astounding. It's also the fact that conservation, needs to recruit more financial resources to be able to promote effective alternatives to the way that, say, the logging industry is approaching timber and the fishery industry look at fish stocks. We need to try and start speaking the same language and talking in terms that can be understood and still leave us with a positive economy.
You also need, it seems to me, a whole lot more money to do what you're doing. You're resources are incredibly limited for the job at hand.
If you compare how we go about our investments in conservation projects with how industry approaches it, we are a factor of 100 down below what a timber logging company will go into a country with. It's really that stark. So we need to try and work with those organizations to make sure that their approaches do not have completely detrimental impacts.
Mm-hmm. The criticism of the hotspot approach, of course, you're familiar with, but if you just designate certain areas, what about all the areas in between? What about how global warming affects the whole planet and affects all the other species? Do you need to take a larger view of this?
We do. Conservation International also addresses areas which are called high biodiversity wilderness areas, which are areas like the Amazon Basin and the forests of Central Africa, which have very low population density, and their habitat is largely intact. They still have that threshold of 1,500 endemic species of plants. So we are much more broad than simply focusing on hotspots. But we do need to sort of look at how these regions can act as shock absorbers for climate change and and how species will start going up to higher altitudes as the lower lowlands become hotter and hotter and drier through climate change, which is an inevitable situation now.
Mm-hmm. How big are captive and where are they taking place, captive breeding programs for certain species, John?
Captive breeding is another tool that we use, and that's also it's a very useful approach. It's a last resort in many ways. Captive breeding is important, but what we also have to do is make sure that we know how and when we're going to be able to release those species back into the wild, because that's the reason for maintaining these species in captivity. Zoos play an important role for their education and awareness component, and also providing the technical expertise to make sure that captive populations are well managed and they don't become interbred.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about programs in, let's look at the successful ones, actually, where captive breeding has been incredibly important. And we've been able to release the animals back into the wild.
Yeah, well, the golden lion tamarin is the big icon of a successful approach by conservationists and zoos to bring together all the zoological specimens and then have them released back in Brazil. And that's been a hugely important, iconic success, and it's a very, very enigmatic species. There are other success stories, and also the number of plants that are threatened, that, which are down to just one or two individual trees in some forests in Madagascar that are the last standing remnants of these species.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people like to think about the big, cute and fuzzy things that are running around, but actually plants are important to bear in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been quite some success in releasing gorillas from the bushmeat trade, gorilla orphans from the bushmeat trade in places like Congo Brazzaville and Gabon, which again is a very long and slow process that demands a considerable amount of money and an awful lot of time and love to make that successful.
We're going to welcome phone calls for John. We'll take them in just one moment. Our guest is John Watkin, Grant Director of Critical Ecosystem Partnership Fund at Conservation International, and we're talking about the number of species that we're losing every day and the attempts to preserve biodiversity in particularly hot spots on this planet, which has been the way this organization has gone for a number of years now, focusing on hot spots, not ignoring other parts of the world, but looking at regions of the world like tropical rainforests that have much richness in species, and yet they're losing them rapidly to lumber industries, et cetera. We're welcoming your calls at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow we broadcast live from Marquette University as we get very close to the presidential election. First hour of our program, we'll talk with journalists and political analysts about this race. And the second hour, because much has been written about, talked about concerning the youth vote in this country, we'll be talking with Marquette students who are working with various campaigns, presidential campaigns. So join us if you can't be there in person from 9 to 11. Join us certainly via the radio tomorrow as we talk politics. All right, two phone calls, 800-486-8655. Start with Sarah from Pell Lake. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, good morning. And have a safe trip tomorrow, Kathleen.
Oh, thanks.
I have two questions. The first one is I'd like to hear more about insects. We're losing insects at an incredible rate, and they are so important to the ecosystem. I'd like to hear more about that. And number two, a lot of destruction of the ecosystems are caused by outlying factors. You have, for example, the rainforest in South America is caused because of the poor people. They're trying to find ways to make money, so they cut down the forests, they have the cattle, which destroys everything with it. And in Africa, you have a lot of the same problems going on with poor countries going in there, harvesting the meat because that's where their money comes from, especially with the loans they get and just a lot that goes into this. And I'm wondering if they're working with some of the some of the cultures and the people who rely or are part of partly destroying this for food, to try to get them to work more within the ecosystems themselves to help save some of the animals.
Thank you, Sarah. John?
Sarah, thanks for the question, and you're absolutely spot on. Insects are just another component of the overall integrity of these ecological systems, and we're trying to make sure that the system itself stays intact, and by virtue of that, that the insects will be included in the conservation efforts. There are specific approaches. One of the downsides to a lot of insects is that if they've been moved to other habitats, they actually become invasive species, and it can be very, very detrimental. Examples of that are like the red fire ant, which is all around the Pacific Rim, and actually if it gets to some of these Pacific islands, it poses a huge threat to all the local fauna and ability to produce crops. But your point about these external factors impacting people locally and the people who are in abject poverty trying to just simply make a living and send their children to school and cover medical bills is absolute. We work very closely with community groups to promote their livelihoods and little things like improving how they harvest honey and how they process the honey, which increases the market share that they will get and the amount of money they get for the honey. Simple stuff like modern hives and also having a centrifuge to spin off the honey so it becomes much more pure than having a lot of the wax and the mess that's left behind. So we do that. We also work with a lot of the policy makers. We have a big government liaison program here at Conservation International that works with governments to make sure that any of these bilateral or international agreements that are made do not have a negative impact on resources. Some of the things you can never win. You look at opportunities that are available under palm oil, and palm oil is used for a huge array of things, and it's very, very highly in demand now. An artifact of that is that people are removing virgin habitat, pristine habitat, and then planting oil palms. So that's something that we want to try and make sure doesn't happen again, because destroying native habitat is probably the biggest sin that anybody can undertake at this time.
Anything else, Sarah?
There's so much that gets fed into this, and there's so much that goes around it. It's so hard to try to deal with every little aspect of it, and I'm so glad that there are people out there doing it. But some of the things that I guess we could do is do more of buy more fair trade and learn a little more of what's going on economically in the area, because that really ties in with a lot of the destruction, and the more we lose, the more we lose. So thank you so much for coming on and talking about this.
Yeah, thanks, Sarah, for the call. What about consumers? What role do they play in all of this? Is it true you buy more fair trade? Do you need to be? How can you be part of a solution here?
My own personal view is that we need to go back to how people were in the 1950s after the war, after the Second World War, and still a little bit of rationing on various items, especially sugar, which was not. Now, sweets were not stopped rationing until the late 50s in UK, and actually people's health in the UK was better then than ever since. Buying locally, always try and buy locally in preference to something else. Look at where your stuff comes from, because what your power as a consumer was actually determining your ecological footprint, your carbon footprint. So buying apples flown in from very far away places is probably a negative, but if you are prepared to weather the season and eat locally produced seasonal produce, you're actually doing the best you can. But everybody can make their own contribution to the overall impact, and consumer power is very important.
Let's go next to David from Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, David.
Yes, welcome. I have to agree with the previous caller, having to be more sustainable and work on. Another thing that made me think of what she was talking about is war. It's such a horrible thing. I mean, what they're doing in Iraq with the uranium bullets and stuff is just cancer rates are going up. But the thing I called about, I saw Nova the other day talking about fractals, And it was really interesting. They were saying that the fractal geometry of one tree is also very similar to the fractal geometry of the whole forest. And they also were telling about that your heartbeat is actually also conforms to this fractal geometry. And they're thinking that in the future, they could use this fractal geometry to tell the difference between a healthy heart and a diseased heart. I was thinking, hey, could Drupai do that with the ecosystem still? If we understand this better and stuff, we could maybe spot things a lot quicker and sooner, understand this new branch of mathematics.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the word. What kind of geometry?
Fractal. It's you see those really interesting designs with a little, like, paisley-like, and essentially... You you take a line and take out the middle part, then you take those two lines and take out another middle part. And it's a repetitive process.
I see.
And there's all sorts of different things with fractal, but it's sort of a... The thing that sort of gets the mathematics is that you do this equation, then you repeat it on itself.
Mm-hmm.
And you get very fascinating designs and stuff. But it turns out, in nature, the natural processes, you know, when they first came out, everyone sort of poo-pooed it just as a thing. But it turned out it showed up everywhere in nature, in living mm-hmm. organisms. It just keeps on showing up. And it's, I guess, really starting to take off as a field.
Mm. John?
Yeah, David, it's an interesting point. I would caution... err on the side of caution with proposing new mathematical analyses of data that we aren't too sure of the actual integrity of the data overall. One of the things that's happened recently at the World Conservation Congress that was held in Barcelona is that an analysis that's very similar to how the Dow Jones and other financial measures have been compiled has been done for species. Again, it's an interesting idea, but I think proof of the pudding is in the eating. We have to see how they bear in mind, but it's all well and good modeling and trying to provide short and snappy answers to big questions, but overall we just need to make sure that we are solid on our understanding and data and are being able to measure these changes that are if impacting us all.
Thanks so much for your call. We have some lines open if you'd like to join us. John Watkin is our guest, grant director for the Critical Ecosystem Partnership Fund at Conservation International. Our number 800-486-8655. Kurt is next from Green Bay. Hi, Kurt.
Hi. Actually, my question has to do sort of with a follow-up on both the previous questions. And first of all, I wanted to applaud your work. I very much support what you're doing. However, my question goes to when you reintroduce a species into the wild, how do you sort of balance that? Obviously, most species are prey to some other species and predators to other species. How do you sort of work that out to restore the natural balance again?
Kurt, that's a great question.
Mm-hmm.
The reintroduction is a new science in many ways, and it's something that we're still developing the tools for. But you know, there's been several successful reintroductions. The Arabian oryx is one example, which is hugely successful. When a species is removed from the system, the other species around start to fill its niche in terms of the amount of food it consumed and minerals that it required to survive. So when they did the reintroduction, they actually put it in at a time when there was higher production within the desert so that the species could survive and it was able to get enough food for its own requirements. They were given some supplementary food during difficult times as they relearned how to forage in the wild. So it's a very slow and long-term process, and you do need to have careful monitoring of the other species around. But it can be done, and that's something that is positive. It's really, along with captive breeding, it's a last resort. We actually want to try and make sure that we don't get to that point and make sure that the systems stay intact.
Mm-hmm. Do you deal with the oceans at all?
We do. Conservation International has a significant marine program. you know, the oceans, it's a huge issue because everything, virtually everything we touch has a link to some product from the marine world. The other thing is it's not so easy to measure what's been happening because it's so difficult to visualize everything. We can measure deforestation from satellites, but we can't see what's happening to corals or to the seabed. The marine conservation approaches are looking at seascapes, and these are areas around the world rather like hotspots that are extremely important. And then looking at trade, the number of shark species that are very, very close to extinction now as a result of finning for the Japanese market. It's really something that is cultural, and we need to try and find the right language and cultural approaches to try and influence the demand in Japan and China for a lot of these products that we realize are having massive detrimental impact around the world.
We have been measuring the disappearance of corals, though, haven't we, in some fashion?
We have, and coral bleaching as a result of climate change and climatic event, El Nino especially, is something that can be done, and that's because it's within the near shore often. We can actually easily go out and survey, and there have been many programs undertaking surveys over a long time. So we know what's happening on a sort of site-by-site basis, but trying to extrapolate that out to, say, the whole of the Indian Ocean or the whole of the Pacific is something that we've yet to do.
We thank you very much for your call, Kurt, and go next to Gary from Northeast Iowa. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I wanted to ask a question about species extinctions and global climate change. I've been on the front lines of working with endangered species here in the upper Midwest for about 30 years dealing with the tall grass prairie ecosystems. And we have some serious problems here. We've lost 99.9% of the tall grass prairie. And some of the issues that we struggle with are invasive species and also to some extent showing up more and more as climate change. And it just seems like an overwhelming job to try to preserve these species when you start losing insects and microscopic soil life and plant species. And we have working with absolutely no information about some of these species, how to manage them, and not to mention managing with very rudimentary techniques, basically hand labor and using fire. And it just seems like all these techniques are, we're just being overwhelmed by all of the factors that we face and the onslaught for the demise of these ecosystems. And I'm just looking for some kind of, I guess, encouragement. And I'd also like to ask your guest about his viewpoint on the connection with species extinctions globally and the altering of human evolution because of the lack of interaction with some of these species.
Hmm. And let me just ask you, you've lost the, maybe you said this and I missed it, the tall grass prairie has been replaced by what?
It's been replaced by urbanization and cornfields, agricultural land.
Mm-hmm. John.
Gary, it's lovely to speak to clearly an expert in the field. And my heart goes out to you for your struggle against invasive species, especially plants, which are the most insidious thing to try and deal with. They are causing huge problems, in especially the Pacific region. I can't do anything more to encourage you than to say, look, I really do empathize with what you're trying to do, and it sounds like you've been using the most relevant tools in terms of fire and fire management regimes to keep the tall grass prairies going. One of the points about climate change and it causing extinction, this is something that's been studied extensively, and actually my advisor when I was doing my master's at the University of Durham in the UK was a man by the name of Brian Huntley, and he's been spearheading a modelling approach to looking at these issues. And the results are terrifying in terms of species that are able to move in line with climate change, but there are also many species that just either have nowhere to go because they can't go any higher in altitude because there is nowhere higher, or that they can't move at a rate that's going to respond to the speed with which the climate is migrating. This is where these computer models come in, and it's quite ironic that David's point about fractal geometry I was cautious about, but actually I fully support models to try and predict what will happen with climate change. And your last point about the human evolution changing as a result of not having contact or exposure to these species, this is something that I think will be a long-term legacy, that we will be talking about elephants and giraffes and lions in two or three generations' time. Tigers, especially, we'll be talking about those as either zoo species only or the fact that they'll be mythical, just like the unicorn. Mm. So I think that's something that we really do need to be aware of, that as a very wealthy or residents of a very wealthy country, that we do have an obligation to try and preserve these species that have such vital importance to us as we grow up.
Do you have any belief, that figure is pretty astounding, 99.9% loss of the tall grass prairie. How in the world are you going to bring it back at this point, Gary?
Well, we really don't have much opportunity to bring it back, because the land that was tall grass prairie is critical to our economy and to our food production and our lifestyles. But again, like your guest said, we try to find areas where there's concentrations of bits and pieces of these prairies and then develop corridors between them.
Right.
One of the problems we run into is that with some of the state agencies that are overseers of our resources, each branch has different priorities, and we oftentimes find that the priority of a specialist and ecosystem management is at odds with the specialist in another branch of the ecosystem management and preservation. So a lot of things that go on are counterproductive to one another, and many of these agencies don't work off the same page. They have their people that are trained in a specific area, and they have knowledge in that area, but when they get out of that area and into other areas, for instance, fisheries, people are trained in fish management, but they know very little about wetland preservation or about prairie restoration. So some of the things that one agency does are counter to another agency, so you're stuck that way too. So it's a very difficult task to try to do.
Thanks, Gary, so much for your call. We're welcoming more phone calls. Our guest this hour is the Grant Director for the Critical Ecosystem Partnership Fund at Conservation International. John Watkin is our guest, and we're talking about how to preserve the maximum number of species, how many we are losing, the successful attempts to bring species back, and overall a question of why it's important for us to consider this. 800-486-8655, and our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome phone calls for John or emails as well. Again, our number, and we have some lines open, 800-486-8655 is the number. And our email is talk@wpr.org. We go next to an email from Doug. What other species, John, has as much impact on its environment as humans do? What happens to a species that overpopulates its environment? What does that suggest for the human population?
All right, that's a great, great question. The species that has most the most impact, or as much an impact on its habitat as humans, are beavers. But they actually have a positive impact, because the creation of dams and the eddies that are produced in the little pools create a mosaic within the habitat.
Hmm.
And beavers have been so missed from northern England, actually, and Scotland, that they've actually had a program recently to reintroduce beavers into Scotland from populations in Europe.
Where have they gone?
I think the location's secret, but it's up in Scotland, in a remote part that's that was chosen as an ideal habitat for them to re-establish a population.
Hmm. But why have they lost population?
Beavers became extinct because I think in the 1600s the Pope said that they were fish and could be eaten on a Friday by Catholics.
Oh my gosh, I never heard of that. Really?
Yes. So there's all these historical legacies that we have. But again, people didn't like them because they caused problems when they were trying to drain agricultural land to stop planting. So again, a lot of human persecution. But there's a lot of amazing stories out there about how people interpreted bird migrations, for example, that they all thought they disappeared, like the barnacle goose. They felt that it just disappeared and became a fish because they couldn't understand that these birds could be so numerous at one point in the year and then disappear entirely. And because the head was black and the neck was rather like a barnacle, they were named barnacle geese. I think the point about when species become overabundant and their impact, these populations crash, bloom and crash in natural systems, and you have a lot of regulation built into that in natural systems. It's when those systems are disturbed that you have the real ramifications. But generally, natural systems are kept in a very level balance. It's only when we start doing agriculture and having just one crop for a significant area that disease can start take hold and move very swiftly, which is why then we end up having a lot of additives to make sure that you don't get fungus or other diseases of wheat or barley as it's grown in a single crop stand. Invasive species, when they get into an area that's favorable for them, they just explode and they start taking over everything. And that's something that needs to be managed very actively by people responsible. And you can understand why a country like New Zealand have very strict quarantine or very strict customs rules about what you can import. So Hilary Swank had a to do with New Zealand immigration authorities or customs authorities a couple of years ago over an apple. But the thing that they didn't explain was that the apple could have contained the pupae of probably a parasitic wasp that could have got in and decimated the fruit crop of New Zealand.
So, my goodness,
there were reasons for that,
right?
And they're very, very and rightfully so, very, very strict on those sorts of aspects. I think if we try and look at what happens to those populations and how that could be an example for human populations, I don't think the future is bright. I think we're going to get to a point of ecological collapse, and that's going to end up coming around and affecting people. And I think when conservationists talk about individual species, the ultimate extrapolation of that is we will end up having to try and find ways to conserve ourselves, because we will go beyond what's referred to as the tipping point and just end up with having toxic water, no fresh water to drink, let alone use for other things. We're going to be short on food and having a balanced diet. It's really quite daunting. And as we see more and more that a lot of aspects that were thought to be really positive, like trans fats, which don't go off, hence the long shelf life for a lot of products, actually had hugely negative impacts on human health. We need to actually be aware of these things. So I try and stay optimistic, but it's pretty difficult to do so in the face of people, whole populations who don't or aren't taking to heart the fact that we all need to compromise a little bit for the global good.
Right. Well, that's a pretty sobering thought there. Let's go to John from Chippewa Falls. Hi, John.
Hi. My question regards malaria and the use of DDT in the third world. I recently heard something about a breakthrough that might interrupt the way the malaria works in people. And it sounds like good news, because the only way people in Africa, the only tool they have is DDT. And how does that fit into our moral workings in trying to control, a devastating disease like malaria that kills thousands of people or more, and trying to keep the biodiversity in the world?
John?
Yep, John, thank you for the question. I think the report might have been slightly erroneous, because DDT is not the only tool that people have. And there's many basic tools, like making sure there aren't areas of standing water for mosquitoes to breed in, to make sure you cover up at night, make sure you sleep under a mosquito net. There are many, many basic tools that people can use to prevent them being infected with malaria. They're not always useful, and malaria does kill over 1 million people a year, so we do need to be very mindful of this. DDT, the problem with DDT was when it was used outside, and it had significant impacts, positive impacts in the 60s and 70s when it was used to reducing the incidence of malaria, but it had immensely negative environmental impacts in the long term, and we all now, all of us contain a bit of DDT in our body fat. Even penguins have DDT in their body fat, although they're never exposed to it. It's just now so ubiquitous throughout the natural system because it does not break down. So malaria is a huge, huge issue. It's a massive humanitarian issue. I'm hoping that with all the research that goes into how this parasite works, which is an amazing piece of engineering, of natural engineering, that we will find a way to find a chink in its armor and make sure that so many people aren't affected or die from this disease.
Mm-hmm. We have another email here. Are there places on Earth that are extremely healthy that we can learn things if we examine those healthy spots on Earth? Any areas that are untouched and unaffected by humans or by climate?
Difficult question. A lot of healthy is sort of eye of the beholder thing. There are remote parts of the world, very remote, in terms of the Amazon and the Congo Basin and also areas in, say, Papua New Guinea. I just think that we need to start taking the same approach to all areas, because if you think that a natural system is imbalanced because of it has regulation control, I think you can extrapolate this on to being of a global importance, that if you have an area producing too much carbon, there are other areas in the world that will be carbon sinks. If we have areas that are receiving a significant amount of rainfall, there are other areas that will need to receive that in terms of replenishing ground aquifers and having fresh water. So I think everywhere is pretty special. Conservation International's approach using hotspots was a way to prioritize where we fund conservation efforts and where we focus on our conservation approaches. Other organizations, such as the World Wildlife Fund or the World Wildlife Fund for Nature and the Nature Conservancy, have their own approaches. And I think when you start overlapping these, you see that we have certain areas which are really important to all of us, and then there are other areas which it's most appropriate for another organization's approach to take the lead.
Thanks so much, John, for your call. Let's go to Ron from Madison. Hi, Ron.
Humans must help trees migrate to climates that will be suitable during the 22nd century. The trees that were here in southern Wisconsin and grew well naturally during the 18th century will not survive here in the future. Therefore, we must help them migrate to Ontario, Quebec, and other places. Likewise, we need to help trees from, say, St. Louis, Little Rock, and Oklahoma City regions, the native trees, the diverse population, to migrate up here to fill in the niches that are going to occur when we warm up the planet by 5 or 10 degrees. I'm most concerned about immobile, long-lived species, therefore walnut, oak, hickory, pecans, etc. Things like tomatoes, potatoes, alfalfa, corn, soybeans, we can move those next year to a suitable climate. But trees that take 10 or 20 or 30 years to reproduce need our help early. That's why I concluded in the last millennium that big government and big business were going to continue stalling and do nothing to slow down the climate change. Therefore, individual humans must act. And I decided that heavy-seeded perennial forest trees were the type of living beings that I could help and that I must focus on. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron.
Ron, that's an interesting point. When you look at climate retrospectively, actually the interglacials and glacial periods are determined by the dominant tree stands around areas that you've been able to take mud cores and actually look at the pollen available. So I think whilst your efforts are laudable, I think it's actually something. I think the trees will actually be able to migrate themselves, but also climate change will act as a selecting factor in speeding up their evolution to adapt. I think we need to look at the real impact of climate change is that the area available for agricultural production will reduce because it will be going up on mountainsides higher and higher as the climate warms, and the areas in between, low-lying areas, will be too hot and dry to produce agriculture. So we'll end up with less space to produce sufficient food for us all.
Mm-hmm. What parts of the world, what countries would you say, John, have been crucial to advancing your cause with the Critical Ecosystem Partnership Fund?
One that stands clear and true is Madagascar, with President Ravalomanana, who has been a huge supporter of a conservation approach and being very, very aware of the threats to the remaining habitat, which is only 15% of original habitat is remaining, and is trying very actively to increase the areas that are under internationally recognized protection, so national parks and other types of protected area, and also to look at marine conservation aspects on the near shore. So Madagascar is a pioneer in that, and I really wish that President Ravalomanana could be showcased more and more, because his stance has been one of the most appropriate around. Hmm. Largely from an economic point of view, he realized that without the forest on the mountains in the east providing their watershed services and having the water, the rainfall through the rivers, which produced some hydroelectric power and provided fresh water for people, that they would end up in a very dire situation down the line. President Kikwete of Tanzania has also been a great supporter of the environmental movement. Again, trying to stamp out corruption within his own government and looking at how to improve the conservation within Tanzania, both the area under...
Oops, hello. Oh, John is gone. We'll get him back on the phone. Our line just dropped for some reason. And having finished that comment, he is talking about... and we also want to guide your attention to the Scientific American, which gave us the idea for this. If you want to read more about the hotspot strategy, it's a special edition of Scientific American. You can just go Google it, and it was written, what is today, the 29th, 2 days ago, special edition, October 27th of Scientific American. Will give you an idea of also a little bit more about what's controversial about this particular approach. So John, we'll try to establish our line with him again for just the remaining minute or so of this program, and have a chance to say goodbye to him. And we also want to remind you that we're going to be at Marquette University tomorrow, which I was going to tell you about at the end of the show, but I will right now. Marquette University Alumni Memorial Union, our special broadcast from 9 to 11 tomorrow. We'll give you a phone number to register in a moment. I'm sorry, John, the line just dropped, so finish your thought and then we have to say goodbye.
Kathleen, thank you. I don't know where I was, but I was just saying that...
We were talking about other countries and...
I'd cited both Madagascar
and Tanzania.
Mm-hmm. And also just looking to the future leader of America, and hopefully that they will actually look at what's out there and what's needed to be done to support, say, the Convention on Biological Diversity for a start, and move that forward, because America has such a huge influence over how the rest of the world operates and its impacts.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, John, so much for being with us. What an interesting and important hour. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
John Watkin is Grant Director of Critical Ecosystem Partnership Fund at Conservation International. We thank him for being with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios. Just a reminder, tomorrow we go to Marquette University. We started our traveling a little bit last January when we were in Dubuque, Iowa, at the beginning of the primaries. It was first primary, right? Or the caucus, actually. So tomorrow we're kind of wrapping it up, going full circle, and we're going to be at Marquette. We'll have political analysts with us and journalists the first hour of the program. The second hour, we'll talk with representatives from the major campaigns, and we'll also be talking with Marquette students as they discuss how they got involved politically and what they anticipate the youth vote will be in this particular election. Is there particular interest among young people in this election? So, and how people are getting the vote out. So all of that will have just a couple days before the election, and it should be a lot of fun. We're going to have a reception afterwards. So if you'd like to be there, you can still give us a call, I guess. Why not? And let us know. It's free, but you just need to let us know that you'll be there so we have a place for you to sit. 414-227-2047. Ask for Katie Mattson, and she'll get you registered, and we hope to see you and have a rip-roaring good time tomorrow, which I'm sure we will. It should be a lot of fun. It's fun to have a live audience and, of course, to talk politics with you and the people at Marquette who are graciously hosting us tomorrow. So that should be great. So until then, lots of interesting conversation coming up here on the Ideas Network. We'll be with you again tomorrow, live from Marquette University at 9 o'clock. I'm Kathleen Dunn. It's a minute before the hour, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.